Here and Now is a production of PRI and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now, Public Radio's daily podcast of news and culture. While 2006 marked a grim milestone of the violence in Iraq with the 3,000th U.S. military death, the year also marked the birth of the 300 millionth American, a number based in part on Census Bureau calculations indicating that a birth occurs in this country every 7 seconds. Although that volume of births is unprecedented, some of the ways we deal with childbirth have not changed very much since the days before record-keeping began. In her new book, author Tina Cassidy traces the history of some childbirth practices and says many of them reflect the culture in which a baby is born. Cassidy's book is Birth, The Surprising History of How We're Born, and Tina Cassidy joins us in studio to talk about this. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for being with us. I read one quote in the book that stood out, and it said that birth always reflects the culture in which it is from. I think that's probably what's indicative in a lot of the stories in the book about the birth and the birth process.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about our culture that's reflected in our birth process right now?
Right. Well, Americans are obviously obsessed with convenience right now. We're a very fast-paced society. So I think a lot of the media stories in the last 5 to 10 years have been focused on mothers trying to manipulate birth to make it convenient for them, scheduling C-sections, doing inductions. In fact, the induction craze is unbelievable in terms of the rate at which that's happening. But I also think that we are a culture that is increasingly reliant on technology. And the trends right now are definitely more towards technology and intervention. The C-section rate is at the highest rate it's ever been in America. Basically, one out of every three babies is born by C-section now. And, you know, there are more than 4 million babies born every year in this country. So the C-section is now the most common operation performed in the United States.
Dangerous?
Well, it is a C-section done perfectly is less dangerous than a complicated vaginal birth. However, a C-section that is unnecessary is more dangerous than a routine vaginal birth. So it's a tricky call.
Let's start with pain relief, since I think that shows a lot about the culture surrounding birth. And I think I was struck by how you described twilight sleep in the book, because my relatives certainly remember that form of giving birth. So can you explain that a little bit and a little bit about pain overall and pain management in childbirth?
Yeah. Well, women, just to start off with a little historical perspective, women have always tried since the beginning of time to find ways to alleviate pain if there was a means available. They chewed willow bark, they chewed cocoa leaves, they drank alcohol. So whatever they could do at the, you know, during crunch time, they did it. Sometimes they chanted, they prayed, they danced, they sang, you know, anything. But one of the more interesting methods of pain relief came about in the early 20th century, and it was called twilight sleep. Basically, it was a mixture of morphine, which is, you know, to relieve the pain, and scopolamine, which is an amnesiac. So it didn't necessarily alleviate all of the pain, but it made her forget. And so women would be relieved of their inhibitions. They would often be tied down. Some had to be put into padded helmets. They were put in beds with crib-like bars. And so there are these wild stories about women giving birth under twilight sleep. And that went on. Twilight sleep was administered. Scopolamine was administered in this country until the 1970s. I mean, my mother had it for me. I was born in the 60s. So it's pretty remarkable how when something gets embedded in obstetrics, it sticks around for generations.
And why is that, do you think? I mean, obviously, it'd be easy to say blatant sexism, wouldn't it? You know, would a woman come up with a pain-relieving drug that would strap other women down?
What's interesting about twilight sleep is that it's women, American women, who actually fought to have twilight sleep brought into America, and they begged American doctors to use it, and the doctor said, no, we don't want it because we think it's dangerous, and indeed it was dangerous. The drugs could make hemorrhage far more likely, obviously meant the male doctor saw what women did to themselves thrashing around during labor. But women equated pain relief then with liberation. It was, again, we go back to this idea that birth is a reflection of the culture and time that it happens. And this was when women were beginning to fight for the right to vote. And so women wanted liberation. They wanted freedom. They wanted to be empowered. And they thought that escaping pain of birth by any means necessary. And that was what was available at that time.
You mentioned that there was chanting and different types of natural, I guess we call them now, natural remedies or herbal remedies. Maybe, you know, now we might think of them as New Age almost to try to relieve pain or something like that. Was there mysticism sort of surrounding the birth process too at the time that it was looked at as a woman's thing that maybe is a little out there that men really didn't have to focus on? It was a woman's issue to deal with, and that may have contributed to some of the feelings about it and some of the practices.
Well, yeah. I mean, as I said, women were always the primary birth attendant. Going back to the beginning of time, and anthropologists believe that one reason why women were the sole birth attendants was because we're the only mammal species that really looks for help during childbirth. It's probably because, you know, deep in our subconscious, we know that birth can be dangerous, so we look for help. And when we look for help, we want somebody who's already been through it before, so we gravitate to other women. That changed a couple hundred years ago with the advent of forceps, and men were the only ones who belonged to a trade group called barber surgeons who were allowed to use tools. So men arrived with tools, and that was really the only way they entered the birth room. Women themselves who were giving birth felt like it was an intrusion. They felt uncomfortable with it, and the men also didn't want to be any part of birth because they didn't want to see a woman going through that, and they really had nothing to offer.
Some of the tools that you describe in the book that some of the men developed, and the fact that they never really attended a live birth until they were actually called to deliver a baby. I mean, some of those things are amazing, and not knowing to wash their hands. I mean, what stands out in your mind from all of that?
Well, some of the tools were horrific. Unfortunately, most of them were destructive tools. I think it's interesting that, you know, in midwifery, women were always taught to use other means. You know, tools were always the last resort, and you know, midwives are sort of regaled for knowing when to be patient, know when to sit on their hands. But men just didn't see it that way, and they had tools they could take care of the problem and move on. Often that meant the destruction of the baby, which was really quite unfortunate. The issue of not washing their hands, that went on for a very long time. You know, to their credit, I suppose, they didn't know any better. This was all before germ theory came along. But when what's interesting is that when birth moved from home to the hospital, this lack of hand washing was going on, and you would have horrible outbreaks of purple sepsis, potentially deadly infection from doctors not washing their hands. They would just go from person to person. Sometimes they would go from cadaver to mother. It's really remarkable. Giving birth in the hospital for a long time was more deadly than giving birth at home for precisely that reason.
And at the time, there were some who believed that the fever was because of the woman's morals?
Yes, of course. They blamed the mother. When hospital births first came on the scene, it was really only for charity patients. Often it would be a prostitute, a single mother, a widow. So these were women who had no place else to turn when they had the baby, so they would go to the hospital. And because of the state of these women, or the status of them, I should say, they were often accused of being, you know, morally degenerate. Mm-hmm. And so if they got sick in the hospital, it must have been because they were having a baby that they shouldn't be having.
We were talking about the mysticism surrounding childbirth and how often the morals of the mother or the midwife were blamed for difficult births. In your book, you write about the transition from midwifery to male doctors. Midwives, in part, were removed from the process because they were considered a threat to the Catholic Church. Why was that?
Because there were so many old wives practices involved in midwifery, you know, midwives weren't officially trained in any particular way. It was more of a skill that was learned, passed down generation to generation. Women would teach each other in the village, and they would nominate or honor a midwife that way. And so some of these folk practices the church found to be morally offensive and threatening.
And at one point, you say that, I think it was your aunt, went to a Catholic hospital and wasn't given pain medication.
Yeah,
and this was 1989. She was
right.
not given pain medication because of the continuing interpretation of the Bible, that
right.
thou shalt bring forth children in sorrow. Is
Correct.
That right?
That is true. It's hard to believe that these things go on for so long, but because of what it says in Genesis, thou shalt bring forth children in sorrow, many clergy believed for centuries that women were meant to suffer when they gave birth, and so pain, any kind of pain relief or medication was viewed as morally reprehensible. Basically, they thought it was a sin. It wasn't until Queen Victoria used chloroform for the birth of her eighth child in the late 19th century that the church had to sit back and say, well, if the queen did it, you know, then it must be okay. And so nobody was willing to criticize the queen. And that sort of opened a new chapter in terms of making women feel like it was okay to partake in pain relief.
Hmm. What do you think was most surprising to you?
The most surprising thing to me was probably the story about the eradication of midwifery and how, you know, this institution of childbirth, the fact that women always had women attending them, it had gone on since the beginning of time, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, very swiftly disappeared in America. I mean, in the early 20th century, doctors basically said, we want midwives out of childbirth. This is our domain now. And they changed all that. I think that is a very dramatic story that has had long-standing consequences for women, for their babies, for the medical system. Of course, midwifery has made a comeback in the last 20 years, and the numbers go up bit by bit every year.
Now, you say when you had your child by cesarean section, it surprised you because it mm-hmm. wasn't what you expected.
Right.
There may be some folks who may say, well, what did you expect? Mm-hmm. Did you really think it was going to be this mm-hmm. controllable process? Do any of us really mm-hmm. completely control our bodies
right.
and know what to expect? So,
right.
you know, these expectations have been around for a while now.
Right.
There's been sort of people doing birth plans
right.
and saying, this is what I want.
Yeah.
But can you control, really?
Right. Well, what you can control about birth is who attends you, where you have the baby, assuming that you don't accidentally have the baby on the subway or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you start out by making those two primary decisions, I think a lot of what happens in the birth unfolds according to those parameters. You know, if you decide to go to the hospital and deliver with an OB, then those are going to give you a certain set of options. You know, most likely today you're going to have an electronic fetal monitor when you get there, an IV. You're more likely to have a C-section if you start out in a hospital. You're very likely to end up with Pitocin, which is an induction drug. In fact, half of the women who go to the hospital today end up with Pitocin. I don't think a lot of women know those statistics, though, when they're making their decision.
Mm-hmm. And so do you suggest that they evaluate those and challenge the medical decisions while they're involved in the process?
I think that the moment of birth is a difficult time to be having an argument with
right.
your obstetrician.
Right.
I think that's another thing that I learned myself. You know, those decisions and those discussions need to happen long before you go into labor.
So, and then obviously the unexpected can often happen.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's a real ambivalence about this type of medicine. We're not dealing with a disease,
mm-hmm.
and yet medical intervention is necessary.
Right.
And it's birth, and
right.
it's women, and
right.
it's got all of these components to it that makes it a different thing.
It is so different, and it's so politically charged still today. I mean, I guess naively thought that a lot of the political issues died 20 years ago, but they have not. I mean, I just got off of a 15-city tour talking to women about this very subject, and everywhere I go, women have very, and men too, and doctors and midwives and everybody involved in birth, they all have extremely passionate views on the matter. And I tried to cut through some of that political stuff in the book and look at what the scientific surveys found. But the science is, you know, has a political slant to it.
Right.
You know, doctors are going to be evaluating C-sections and midwives are going to be evaluating home births, and they don't really evaluate each other. So it's so complicated, and women end up stuck in the middle trying to make decisions that are very difficult to make.
So how does it improve?
Well, I think it improves woman by woman, and women have to be the ones who decide for themselves how they want to give birth. That is a very powerful decision to make. It is not a light decision. It's not just about you and your baby. I mean, it really is a reflection of the culture. You can look back throughout history and see that women were the ones who had the power and control to say, now we want pain relief, you know, when twilight sleep came around. And then a generation or two later, they said, twilight sleep is crazy. We want no part of that. Let's get natural birth going. And now today, women are saying, oh, I'm having one, maybe two kids. All I care about is convenience and the perfect baby. So let's just go with all the medicine and technology you can throw at me. And so, you know, if women decide they don't want that anymore because too many of them are getting sectioned or they don't like how they have lost so much power or control at the hospital, that's when we're going to start to see some of a backlash going on. And it all depends on what women want.
And the pendulum will keep swinging.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Tina Cassidy, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Tina Cassidy is author of the new book, Birth, The Surprising History of How We Are Born. Here and Now is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tune in weekdays at noon for live, up-to-the-minute news from around the world, and visit our website, here-now.org, for more on today's top stories. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now,